It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Ear hair. I want to talk about it.
You want to what?
I want to talk about ear hair.
Oh, you want to talk about it? Okay.
Yes. They say you get it as you get older.
Yeah, I guess.
Now, pretend I'm a person who doesn't know, who's not familiar with the term ear hair. Explain it to me.
Explain what ear hair is?
Yes.
Well, first of all, I don't know if I'd say it's something you don't have till you're older, but it seems like when you get older, the hair in your ears, and a lot of people, it's their eyebrows and their nose also, starts to get rather long. Like, it's noticeably long, like people will see.
And by in your ears, you mean?
Like, inside the little ear canal, I guess.
Okay.
But other places, too, they can grow, like, on the back of your ear here, and then and there's other places. But that's usually where people, like, if they buy trimmers when they get older, that's where they're trimming it from, sort of the inside.
This is my thinking, and you get nose versions of that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and eyebrows and that whole thing.
I'm very sick, people. There's going to be a lot of coughing in this episode. I apologize. I got a cough drop going. You can see it's working really well. I have a hair growing out of my earlobe. Just one.
Sure. Yeah, that's sometimes where they are.
Just one, though. And it gets really long. Like, ugh.
Oh, it's a usual thing. Like, it keeps coming back.
Yes.
In the same place, I see. Yeah.
It's insane. I hate it. When I was younger, I had one gray eyelash that would do the same thing. It would grow to like 3-4 inches. I don't know how long the maximum is because we would cut it eventually.
Hmm.
But I used to have it when I was younger. I don't know if we finally plucked it or what, but it went away.
Interesting.
But now I got one growing out just the side of my earlobe. And it gets like really long, and like basically every once in a while, when I have, like, nail trimmers or whatever, I just trim it. But it drives me nuts. I do not like it.
Yeah, it is pretty weird, that kind of thing.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Magical Talking Hat Podcast. The only podcast in the world made with 4 kinds of cheese. We refuse to tell you which kinds, but there's 4.
Yeah, he doesn't even tell me what they are because he's sure I'm going to give it away.
Yes.
And he's probably right.
He's,
I would probably.
He's essentially, you know those Bush's Baked Beans commercial? He's my dog.
Yep, that's pretty much right.
I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 446.
And it was going to be a two-parter, but now it is not because I'm very sick. So we'll just have to hope that next week, evil can help us out.
I'm so sorry you feel bad. If the reason we were going to do a two-parter was because I'm planning to not be available next week.
Yes.
And had that not been true, we might have had the evil guys help us tonight. You wouldn't have to suffer through this.
Then we could do that. But no.
So it's my fault. I apologize.
Well, this is happening for a long time. I've been getting snottier and snottier. And I bought some Sudafed and I'm taking that. But it's getting worse and worse and worse. And Tuesday it really got bad. And Tuesday night was really bad. And Wednesday I wake up and I'm like, I can't function, my head
is
all that. So I stay home from work, and then I sleep a lot, I drink a lot of fluids. By the end of the day, not as bad.
Oh, well, that's good.
So go to bed last night, wake up in the morning, still not too bad today, go to work. And day goes on, it's not too bad, I'm a little surprised. We finally got the 12 hours to the vet. Those are hard to get a hold of now. They really think you're going to make meth out of them.
Yeah.
I got them, and that's run through and all that. And at a certain point, I'm like, uh-oh. Because I can feel my chest is starting to get something.
Mm-hmm.
And by about lunchtime, I'm coughing and I'm tasting phlegm, which is just a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been going downhill since then. So we'll see what happens, but it's not good so far. So, for those of you just joining us, this is what it sounds like every time.
Every time.
It's different illness every time. last week was thrush. We didn't talk about it as much because it didn't doesn't really come up when you're recording.
Right.
I mean, it's not a... Same thing with the gout week.
We didn't talk about it a lot. Whooping cough,
though, I mean, that was pretty much the only topic we had the whole time was whooping cough.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to miss.
Sometimes when it's a slow week, we'll have bunion week.
Yeah.
That's not as interesting at all.
Munchausen by proxy week was deleted. We aren't going to let anybody hear that one. That one was awkward.
Thanks for bringing that up. I forgot.
Yeah. I just wanted to take care of you. So we have a hat. It's magical. In that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Folks like yourselves, cool people, hopefully in better health people, and people who will help us out, because we are still in desperate need of help on this, write in to that email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with little notes, comments, topics, questions, things like that. Ugh. Hour of this shit. Esophageally challenged. Servants. Draw the note cards out of the hat. Read them on the air. Oh, sorry. Draw them out at random. Read them on the air. We talk about them till we're bored. We do that for about an hour. That's the whole show, except the parts that aren't, which is most of it. I had a linguistic epiphany the other day.
Another one?
Yes. Revolting.
Revolting.
Yes.
The word.
The words.
Words. Oh, like
there's
a
an
revolt,
adjective.
Like we're staging
and
a
verb. Okay. And that's the thing. So the gerund version of both revolution and revulsion are revolting, which then makes me wonder if revolt and revile have a common word root, which seems weird to me.
Hmm.
They seem very different.
Did you look it up?
No.
Oh.
I don't do that. You met me?
You do too, look stuff up. You go down wiki rabbit holes.
Yeah, but never intentionally.
Okay.
I will accidentally do shit like that.
Okay.
No, I just popped into my head. Anyway. Has it just been a week? No. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
How was your week?
Well, we started to watch Lucifer, as a matter of fact.
Why?
My wife was curious about it.
Ooh, how you feel so far?
I thought it had a strong pilot. It feels like where the series starts in a place that you could go to the comic, not the part that Gaiman was writing.
But actual Lucifer.
Yeah.
Gaiman didn't write any Lucifer.
You could go to that comic and you could find a place where the pilot and the comic are roughly the same spot. But then after that, they diverge fairly dramatically from one another.
Well, the whole premise, I mean, there's no cop in the comic book.
But
there's none of that business.
Even though that happens, it feels like it's just a different version of the same character. It feels like that to me. I don't know.
It's based on that character.
Well, right, but a lot of times they'll say that and then it won't be anything like the character.
In my opinion, it is nothing like the character.
Okay, well, I got the impression that it at least started like the character and then sort of took a turn that very different.
My central complaint that has existed since the beginning, and no offense to Tom Ellis, he does an amazing job. He has the potential to play a great Lucifer. The Lucifer in the TV show does not understand how humans work. And that does not match the character in the comics, nor does it match just the concept of Lucifer. He knows really well how humans work.
Yeah.
And he is constantly, year after year, season after season, baffled by their motivations and their way of thinking about things. Also baffled by the basics of how police procedure works. After years of doing it, he still feels, oh, I don't like this guy. He's clearly the murderer. Let's just go arrest him. Like, that works. He learns no lessons.
Oh, really?
Yes. It's not a good show. I'm still watching the show. I don't recommend it to anyone. It's not a good show.
Well...
Also, no offense to Laura German, but Chloe is annoying as hell.
Other things he said, he seems to be... Going along with what you were saying about, he doesn't seem to know how people work, which is weird for Lucifer, the classical version of Lucifer. I mean,
and the comic book version of Lucifer.
Well, yes, but even the classic version, I mean, nobody knows humankind better than Lucifer.
It's kind of his deal.
Yeah, sometimes people even say Lucifer knows humankind better than God or Jesus or whoever. That's usually the angle they take, and he'll be telling people who he is and seem oblivious to the fact that they don't believe it or whatever. It's like...
Yeah.
That doesn't seem
that
right.
Does not get better. That does not get better.
The thing, but none of that actually bothered me very much. It's kind of interesting. The thing that has bothered me so far, and we haven't finished the first season, is the representation in it is bad in a way that a lot of people don't think of representation being bad, which is the people are there. But they're being used in such a terrible way, it's almost worse than if they weren't there at all. For example, many times when Lucifer comes up against an obstacle to what he wants, that's going to be a person. And generally when a person is an obstacle to what you want, that's going to be a person that has some authority or is important. So when you're watching the show and that person is a woman, especially a woman of color, you're liable to think, oh, wow, you know, a woman doesn't usually get a role like that. But if you think again, you'll go, oh, yeah, but she's going to be nothing here pretty soon, because the only reason they cast her in that role was so because he's going to come up and seduce her or, you know, reduce her to jelly or whatever and then get what he wants.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they probably would have put a man in that role. So then the representation actually does the opposite of what you would want it to do in that situation.
I will say I don't think they did that particularly intentionally, and I do think they get better at that. Because I will say the whole Lucifer just goes up and seduces them and they spill the beans doesn't play out in every episode forever. They do eventually, like, they go to that well a lot, but they do eventually stop.
Well, but maybe related to it, though, is how orientation is represented. Because... These are presumably heterosexual women that he's constantly, I mean, just immediately they're putting his hands.
Oh, and they suck at how orientation is represented.
Well, right. So then when you get to, like, bisexual people are in the show, but they have almost no lines, and they're only there to say, oh, look, Lucifer can have his sex with as many people as he... It's usually setting up like he's going to have a threesome or a foursome or something.
Well, no, and this is where it's the biggest issue, because the devil, quite understandably... is bi. It is, I would say, pansexual.
Sure, right.
It comes up almost never, and usually as a joke.
Yes, exactly.
Like, he is supposedly pansexual, and yet virtually never does he show any interest in a man. But he constantly shows interest in just about every woman.
Well, like in the second episode, they showed him waking up with a man and a woman.
Yes, and they'll do the passing things like on occasion. Well, but later seasons, again, they get a little bit better about that, but in general, no. He's all about the ladies.
But this is another thing is, you know, if they're only casting this woman because they want a heterosexual woman to, like, fall apart for this guy, didn't it ever occur to them that, well, it could be a gay man or a bisexual man if you're going to be like that? Because clearly the heterosexual men are impervious to this.
Yes.
To his charms.
It was a show on primetime Fox, so no, it did not occur to them.
Well, but another thing that... So the heterosexual women are turned into props, basically. Bisexual people are marginalized the way they usually are, unfortunately. And gay women are erased.
Yeah.
There's one point where he says, I've never met a woman who I didn't have this effect on, which by the logic, internal logic of the show means he's never met a lesbian before. So yeah. It's like they don't even exist in the world. Yeah. So it's like, this is weird. I mean, I realize that this started some time ago. I don't remember when the first season was. I mean, well, not that long ago.
No, we just had the fourth season. I'd say it's about 5 years ago. Yeah, no.
It seems remarkably unenlightened.
None of the problems in it are from aging at this point.
Yeah, that's pretty bad for that stuff.
Here's what I would tell you. If you are determined to continue with this folly of watching the show.
And I don't know if we are, but...
Pay attention to the regular cast members that are not Chloe and Lucifer.
I don't even know if we've met Chloe yet. Is she in the first season?
Chloe's literally the female lead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I always forget her name.
Yes.
Because they hardly ever say it. It's detective. He's always calling her detective.
Amenadiel. Mazikeen, who again, they do really bad in comparison with the comics, but she is a different kind of character that works well. The therapist.
Yeah.
Later on, a couple of characters that will show up in second season. Pay attention to these. The show... Oh, Esposito, Dan.
Oh, yeah.
These characters will, over time, form an ensemble that is actually kind of interesting. The two main characters, and to that extent, the crimes they solve, are far and away the shittiest thing about the show. And unfortunately, that's 90% of the show. But as time goes on, it becomes 80% of the show, 70% of the show.
Well, the thing is, I've seen worse setups for a non-cop being another cop's partner.
Yeah.
I mean, Castle was so much worse in that regard than this show is. They seem to put some effort into it.
The chemistry was there. That's the other thing, is I've never bought the Chloe Lucifer will they, won't they.
Oh, yeah.
As it changes and grows, like, it never felt real to me. But Castle also started a little bit better as an ensemble. Mm-hmm. The other two cops were, like, heavily involved and things like that. Mm-hmm. And this one doesn't. But it figures it out eventually. Rachel Harris, who I already loved, as a comedian, who plays Linda, the therapist.
Oh, yeah, right.
She's the reason I'm glad this show exists, because this was such a great thing for her and showed she really had chops and, like, gave her... She has a brilliant arc. And like I said, two different characters show up second season. One, we get a medical examiner who's very cool. But then we also get another character who I won't even start to explain. And they... change things a lot. As the show goes on, it gets more mythic. It gets more interested in the supernatural aspects. And that's cool. Amenadiel has a whole past. But of course, that actor's been around for a while, and he's really good.
Yeah, he's done voice acting too, I think.
And Mazikeen is hilarious. And even Trixie, the kid, does pretty well as time goes on. But yeah, you basically have to ignore the two main characters, and then the show gets better. But it still doesn't get good. I still don't recommend it. At all.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll keep watching or not. I mean,
If you make it through season three, keep watching, because four is noticeably better.
Oh.
It's not worth it, but if you already tortured yourself to season three, four is like a little reward for you.
Yeah. Well, we...
it's also when the show goes completely off the rails. But.
American Horror Story Apocalypse is on Netflix now, so we started watching that. And it's fine, but we haven't watched that much of it yet. But how was your week? Aside from being sick.
We started Carnival Row on Amazon. And actually, we have watched 5 of the 8 episodes.
Mm.
Somebody's weed whacking and the windows are open, so that's the other background noise. I apologize. Are you familiar at all with Carnival Row? I know you don't have Amazon.
I know of it. And recently, my wife signed up for a 30-day trial for Amazon because...
Oh, yeah.
She wanted to get free shipping on something.
Yeah, we used to do that around Christmas time every year.
We probably won't keep it, but we might try to watch some
shows.
It's
only 8 episodes. There is a lot to like in the show, and there's a lot not to like. It's been getting very... It has not been well received critically. That being said, it's getting a second season.
Mm.
It's strictly speaking, it's a fantasy show. It's made in a fake world.
Mm.
And We're set in probably 19th century, roughly.
Okay.
And our main setting is a place called the Burg, and it's basically Victorian London. Like, in fact, during the opening sequence, there's a pullout, and there's even, like, two bridges, and I'm like, this is London.
Right.
But it's not London. But it looks like London. So, a while back, humanity discovered another continent where the Fae lived, fairy people.
Sure.
And they immediately went to try and take it over. And in the process of that, this other group of people who weren't the fairy people on that same continent started fighting to take over, and it became this huge war, and eventually regular human people were like, screw it, we're leaving. This is set 7 years after that. So now we're set in fictional London, and lots of fey folk have immigrated here, and they're very much second-class citizens and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the main through plot is, back 7 years ago, there was a romance between a man who's from the Burg and a Pix, which is what they call the winged fairy types,
mm-hmm.
from over there. And they had a romance, and then he basically faked his death. And 7 years later, she comes over, and she finds out he's still alive. And he, meanwhile, is a police inspector. And weird shit is happening because it's Victorian London, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But the funny thing is, they seem to be really going for a broader story, because there are several storylines that sprang from this. Like the fairy girl, she showed up and she had a job with this family for a very short time and she left. And we're now following that family, and they have their own plot line that has nothing to do with the rest.
Mm.
So I'm really curious where it's going to play out. It's Victorian London with fairies and with some Lovecraftian undertones that I don't want to give away. And I like it for that. It's a very unique and interesting setting, and it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
They're really playing the racism card. Everybody hates the Fae and looks down on them. And like in their version of Parliament, they're constantly fighting over whether or not they should deport them all back and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
and that gets a little old. And, like, I'm finally discovering our main character is, like, the dumbest person ever. So that's a little weird in places. But it's intriguing. And, like, Trish and I are still watching it, and we complain about it, but we also sit around and talk about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And what we think is going to happen and things like that. And so it's kind of nice for that. And it's, I don't know, I thought it might work for me because the setting really sounded like my jam.
Sure.
And it is for that. But yeah, it's there's places where I'm like, oh, the plot didn't do well here. We had a whole thing the last episode we watched. There was like this 10-minute scene that we're like, this scene doesn't even need to exist. Why are we still doing this? Shut up already. But it's one of those fun things, like characters that I hated, now I'm like, oh wait, that's like my favorite character. Another character that I thought was really awesome, I'm like, oh, screw that. The two main characters, the couple that didn't get together for 7 years or whatever, Orlando Bloom and Cara Delevingne.
I know who you're talking about. She was in Suicide Squad. She was in the Valerian.
Yeah, she played Sorceress in Suicide Squad, which I didn't see. The only place I saw her was as the female lead in Valerian.
Yeah.
And she was terrible. And the movie was terrible. And I don't think it's her fault at all. She was playing the part as she was told to. It was a terrible part.
Yeah.
And the movie was terrible. That's the only thing I saw her in before this. Since then, I've gotten to know her, like, the actor more.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like the actor.
Mm-hmm.
Where she stands politically and stuff like that is very cool. So I'm very pleased to see that she acts pretty darn well, actually, when you put her in something that, like, gives her a chance.
Sure.
So yeah, I mean, especially for being like a short season kind of thing, I think it's worth it. But your mileage may vary. I had some friends who saw it, and like after one episode, they were like, "This is dumb. I'm out of here." So, you'll have to figure that out. I also beat the main story of Assassin's Creed Origins.
Oh.
Which does not mean that I'm anywhere near finished with the game. But I beat the main story. Took forever. It had more endings than freaking extended edition of Return of the King.
Hmm.
You know those movies and things where you're like, here's the end scene, and then, oh no, wait, we had this, and you're like, so we have like 12 epilogues here? I mean, we had so many scenes in this. One dude, I had to assassinate him twice. Like, not even near each other. And it's not like some of the assassinations, you know, you do it, you just kill them and they're dead. But then there's ones that are like a boss fight kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it was like a boss fight kind of thing, and I beat him and killed him, except he wasn't really dead. Way later in the game, I had to do it again. It's again a boss fight thing. It just took forever to end. But it did, so now I'm just wandering around having fun. Doing a lot of other quests and exploring and things. Have not restarted writing Becca James Lundstein because I suck. Am continuing to read The Dispossessed. Am continuing to think you need to be reading this right now. I think you need to be reading this at all times. Once you finish it, you start over again. It's such a brilliant political treatise in the form of not being a political treatise. Like, it is absolutely discussing in great detail political positions, but disguised completely as a story. And not like a stupid one where two people just argue politics. Like, no, it's because it's mostly centered on this one particular character, and you get a lot of his upbringing in an anarchist society and what that means and different points in his life and how he feels about it. There's a whole brilliant and a little bit chilling section where, as like teenagers, him and a bunch of his friends read about the concept of a prison, which is not a thing that exists on their world at all, and they become fascinated by it, and it becomes like a taboo, like a sexy thing for them, and they end up like making a makeshift one, and they're all fighting for like who gets to be inside of it, but then like the impact that has on things.
Interesting.
And like the point at which, like, for him, he's like, it stopped being fun and stuff, and those considerations. And just the different points in his life and how that's varied. And of course, now we're doing the whole, I'm just starting on the part where, like, the cracks are starting to show in the perfect anarchist society. And they even had a section recently talking about, because this is all based off of the writing of some hero, that this all, they have a Karl Marx, basically.
Okay, right.
This woman whose name was Odo, and they'll occasionally say, like, she said you do this, and one of the things was, like, she said there had to be a limit of community sizes, and then they had to have, they'd be sort of sufficient, but you'd have communication and open trade between them. And then they talk about some of the logistical issues related to that, especially because of the planet they're on and things like that. And so I found that stuff very interesting. And yeah, and how it impacts him. And now that he's an older gentleman who's back on the other world, like, compare and contrast to where, how they are and how he is. And he's having moments where he's like, really, he's like, this world that we taught was terrible is kind of awesome. But then he gets moments where he's like, oh wait, this is how it's terrible. And I don't know, it's very interesting. And I'm like a quarter of the way through. Like, it must be a pretty big book. But it's fascinating, and it's absolutely your kind of thing. You should be reading the shit out of this. Like, the fact that you're not reading it right at this moment should bring you shame.
Well, I assure you, I feel plenty of shame right this
also moment. Also, I saw a movie called Media Studies. It's a found footage horror movie thing. It gives found footage horror movies a bad name. Don't see it. It's terrible.
Wow, it gives those movies a bad name?
Yeah, this is the thing.
Wow, I thought they are. Their name was,
and the production values weren't even that bad.
Oh.
But it doesn't help. All your characters are just assholes from jump, which is not good. But also, it's like a 70-minute movie, and the horror shit doesn't really kick in until like 40 minutes in. And also, it turns out to be nothing supernatural. It turns out to be there's a fucked up dude who just kidnaps young women, make sure they're virgins, and then twist at the end, eats them, and then everyone involved dies.
Ew.
Yeah, I was just like, no Satan, no demon, no ghosts coming back. No, it's just a gross dude who is obsessed with the idea that he has to eat virgins. No, that was not an interesting conclusion, you suck. Go away. And yeah, and that's the thing. All the characters, like, at a certain point, I was scared one of the characters wasn't going to die. And I'm like, I'm going to be so pissed off at this movie if he doesn't die. Because he's such an asshole. But he died. Everybody dies. Spoiler alert. Everybody dies. One of them gets eaten. Whatever. Shitty movie. It's called Media Studies. Don't watch it.
Don't watch.
Oh, and then the twist at the very end when, you know, the standard thing in all those movies where there's a camera, like, turned on its side and you're watching someone dragged away or whatever.
Mm.
It suddenly says, a film by, and it gives the name of the professor for all these students.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says, production assistant, and it gives the name of the guy who was eating everyone. What? And then, but that's not, it's not like they use their real names. Then we cut to actual credits. Like, I'm like, what?
Are you saying that this was all a setup by the professor?
Also, what? How would that, that makes no sense logistically, makes no sense motivationally. Yeah, no. That, I'm like, that would, no. Somebody was really drunk one time and they saw the end of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon and they're like, oh, that's what you do. You just do shit that people don't understand and that's the end of your movie. All right. So, yeah, don't watch that movie. Is that it? Did we do all the things?
I don't know. Was there anything else?
Started playing a game on my tablet called Love Balls.
Okay.
Doesn't that sound really gross? It's not. It's adorable. It's a game where on the screen you have two little balls. There's a green one, and, or like a turquoise one and a magenta one. And the screen is still, but then after you do your thing, like gravity will kick in or whatever. And you have to use ink to draw a structure of things that will make it so the balls touch each other. And they have little faces, and when they touch, they're, like, super happy. And so it's like a physics puzzle, basically.
Okay.
And so different levels have, like, you know, oh, this one's up on here. How are you going to do it? Or, you know, because there's no boundary to the screen, so if they fall off the screen, they're gone.
Mm.
So sometimes you have to do it and build. It's kind of cute. It's kind of fun. It's been a good just, like, screwing around game.
Okay. I'll take your word for it.
All right. Do the thing.
Okay, do the thing.
Again, I
always think there's other things
terrible.
I don't remember, but it's not important. Dave Avid wants to know.
Yes, Dave Avid.
If you could survive, which celestial body would you most want to visit and why?
Ooh. I kind of like this.
Well, I mean, I'd probably pick some kind of exoplanet just for the heck of it. But if we're talking about the solar system, just the solar system, do you think?
I mean, if you've got an exoplanet in mind, we should go with that. But
not
if it's just an exoplanet,
well,
yeah, that's not as interesting.
An exoplanet with particular characteristics, I suppose. But yeah, that's not as specific. So in the solar system, I would say, boy, that's tough. If I had to pick just one. Venus, I think.
Interesting.
The thing is, Venus.
That didn't make my short list.
Venus is so close to being like Earth. If it weren't for its thick, hot, and toxic atmosphere, it would, you know, it would be so much like Earth, it's ridiculous.
People say that about me.
So I'd be interested to go there. And it's hard to know what it's really like. Because of that atmosphere. I mean, the gas giants are, you know, what they are. I think a very close second would be Pluto, because I just think there's something cool about Pluto. It just seems like it would
be love Pluto.
Fun to be out there that far away and to look back at the sun and the other planets. I've never been particularly interested in Mars.
Me neither.
As famous as Mars has always been in my life, it's never interested me.
Well, I mean, it's just the easiest to reach. I think is why it's so famous.
I think Saturn's beautiful, and I would definitely like to go and see the rings and everything, but like, I'm thinking of some place where I would actually stand on the surface, providing I could survive, which you wouldn't with Venus, but if I could, I think I would go there, because I think it would be fascinating.
I'm very big on the ones that I find the most mysterious. And so, it depends on how much license we have in this. If I'm just, like, intangible and can, like, go, like, if I could, like, not just the surface, but, like, go inside of, like, Jupiter.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I'm all over that. Or the inside of the sun. Both of those, I'm like, I want to see what's really going on there.
That's good.
And then the easy one, and it was the first one that popped into my head, is Europa.
Sure, yeah, because, I mean...
But there's an aspect to this, though, that in my head... Somehow, when I'm doing this, I'm able to actually properly analyze what I'm seeing.
So you have a certain expertise. And
yes,
so
because if I don't have that, then I just want to go for the prettiest view,
sure,
essentially. And then it's like maybe Saturn, maybe Pluto. Like, if I don't understand what I'm seeing inside them, then why would I bother?
Sure.
But it's just things that I'm like... We quote-unquote know what's going on, but, like, nothing we've ever experienced has actually verified.
Right, right.
Those are the ones I'm very curious about. So, yeah, the inside of a gas giant, I find that concept interesting.
Well, there's a lot of mysteries out there, for sure, just right in our own backyard.
And yeah.
It's always interesting to me when they... learn something new about it or whatever. Recently I was watching these videos about how we would terraform, say, Mars or Venus and so on. And there's no straightforward, realistic way to do it.
No.
But there are ways you might be able to live on Mars, but none of it's going to be, we're going to do something that's going to give Mars an atmosphere. Or...
No, that all requires technology that doesn't exist at this point. But people can theorize.
And even if things, we had that technology, it would still be so hard, you might as well do this other thing. That's easier.
Yeah.
So it's like, even if we could do it, it's never going to be easy to do. It's just gone from impossible to possible. It's not becoming anything that's more... economical or anything like that.
There was something I was thinking of the other day that's a staple of science fiction, such that, like, we almost think we can do it, and we forget that that's not. And it's not the faster than light travel, although that's an obvious one.
Mm-hmm.
What was it? There was something that I'm like, yeah, no, we all know that's what you need in your sci-fi. And I'm like, but yeah, that's a made-up thing. Was it something... I was looking into Dune again the other day. Maybe it was something related to Dune.
I don't know.
Did you ever read Dune?
No.
I would almost recommend it, except... I mean... You get into stuff.
Yes.
And, like, really have to analyze
it.
And so Dune either wouldn't land for you, in which case there's no point, or... It would kill you, I think.
Maybe I just better avoid,
like,
that altogether.
It's or you can do like I will go to Wikipedia and go through it again, and I find that interesting. And I still feel like I stopped at the right spot. I read the first four novels.
I don't know.
I stopped.
I don't know how many there are.
Well, that's because there's not an easy answer.
Oh.
Did you ever see the movie?
I think I've seen two versions of...
There have been two. One's like a miniseries. But
I think
yeah.
I've seen both of them. I think I have.
The original story takes place 10 or 15,000 years after a giant war in which basically humanity fought and defeated AI.
Oh.
And... It then became... They developed essentially almost a religion around... Well, actually a religion. around the idea that then you can't make thinking machines anymore. And so there's a lot of biological alternatives. They learn to train a certain type of individual to essentially be human computational devices. They learn through a particular substance and some low-level technology how people can pilot a ship through what they say call folded space, which is essentially faster than light travel.
Oh, that's the things spice like this. Or whatever. Right?
Yeah. And this is a big thing, is that we can't have any of these things anymore. And so a lot of things are sort of low-tech in a high-tech way. you sort of can't automate anything. But, so the original book takes place at this time. And then we have immediate sequel. And at the end of that sequel, one of the characters from that sort of becomes the new ruler of things. The fourth book is 3,500 years after that. And that guy's still running things.
Oh, lives a long time then.
Yes. And then, the end of that book, that all goes away. And society as we know it, there's a huge diaspora. And the people just take off all over the known universe. And so the fifth and sixth books are then some of them coming back, and there's like whole new plot lines involved because they've gone away and they've changed. And I think it's, again, been several thousand years or something, and people have evolved. And then the author of the books died. And his son had his notes left. Of how there were two more books and how they were going to go. Or I think it was one more book, but they split it in two. So he and a friend decide they're going to do this. First thing they do is write a series of books that take place just before the original series.
Okay.
Then they write a series of books that takes place back when that revolution was happening against AI. Okay. And they tell that whole story. And they more or less made that shit up themselves. And then they write two more books to finish out the original series. And then they write another trilogy that's somewhere in there that just looks at specific things or whatever. But so it's a weird mishmash of how much is the original author and how much is his son based off of notes his father did and how much is his son just making shit up. And it's all over the place in terms of the time scale. So I'm like, yeah, at a certain point, this seems a little too scattered for me. And I feel like the fourth one that ends where everybody, the diaspora happens, is a good ending spot. It makes good logical conclusion sort of the story. Sure. After that, we kind of start a new story, which is weird.
Right.
That was way more boring than it sounded in my head. All right, give me your thing. You'd like it, though. It's all about sociology.
A lot of that older science fiction was. I mean, that's why I really liked Asimov's stuff, is because it's basically sociologically based science fiction.
Yeah. Of course, you should read The Dispossessed before you read anything. Before you even read A Stop Sign.
I think I've got it on a list somewhere. I'll probably order it sooner than later.
This is from Stu. Sounds like someone's overclocking a radio control car out there. That's weird.
Moped, maybe.
That's weird. Anyway.
I have no idea what that
is. What are your current sources of stress, and how do you mitigate them? Stu. I make him go home after we record. That's how I mitigate it. Does Fisher Price make a chainsaw? Is that what we're hearing?
It does sound like a chainsaw when it's really going. I have no idea.
Current sources of stress and how you mitigate them.
I don't have a lot of like consistent single sources. I mean, lately I'm somewhat antisocial. I don't want to be, but I'm kind of struggling with that. So that's most, my stress is mostly about, oh, there's someone, somewhere I have to be.
Yeah.
Or a, you know, like a, like recently we had service guys come into the house. We had some faucets replaced. We had some things. And when people are going to come to the house, it always stresses me out.
No, I get that.
For no real good reason, but just does it. And
it's a disruption.
I don't mitigate it. I just
grit your teeth.
Yeah, you just survive it because it's going to be over pretty soon.
Yeah, yeah.
And that most of the stresses I have, I mean, there have been times in my life where I had prolonged, you know, stress that it was going over a year or a few years.
Yeah.
But right now in my life, the stresses are just like those. It's like this momentary thing. If I just get through it, it'll be gone and I can relax, and so I don't really have to do anything in particular to mitigate it.
The current sociopolitical state of the world is a tremendous stress to me.
Well, that's true. I kind of glossed over that part.
And I try and mitigate it. The problem is I mitigate it with, I don't want to be wholly ignorant of it. I think it's important for me to know the basics. So I try and toe that line. To a degree, my other sources of stress are mostly myself and like goals I have and accomplishing them or not accomplishing them.
Like being frustrated when you don't write.
Exactly.
You
that's written. A very good example.
Yeah, I deal with that a little bit.
I would say the primary, I mean, obviously there's a solution for those things, is just actually do them.
Right, right.
But the primary way I have discovered for dealing with this kind of stress overall, and especially the sociopolitical stuff, distraction. It's a real thing. Like, if you come up with some stupid shit to distract yourself, a video game, a book, reality TV is dumb as hell, but it is remarkably effective if you worry about, like, you know how when I get too frustrated with how terrible the United States' politics is, I look up news on Brexit. Which is not fair, and especially not fair to Stu, A, because I share it with him, and B, because he has family there, so that's mean. But for me, it's like just distanced enough that I can be like, ah, look at those fuckers. Look at the dumb shit that's happening there.
Well, when it comes to things like that, the only way I know I've mitigated is the way I've always mitigated things like that, and that is to talk about them with somebody who is like me, just wants to talk it out and will feel better talking it out.
Yeah, no, for me, it's very much the opposite.
Yeah.
With more personal things, I'll have that. If I'm having an issue with a relationship, then talking it out is better. But when it's just sort of the general, when it's the shit you can't do anything about.
Sure.
Then it's like, no, distraction. I watch dumb movies. I read books. We play games. You know, I get focused on my role-playing campaign instead. And that kind of stuff. And it's, there's something to it. And I've discovered it with grief, too. That can be a thing. If I'm in a horrible mood, if I'm desperately sad over something, if I can distract myself, the day we put Twiglet to sleep,
mm-hmm.
I was like, this is not, like, you're just going to freak out over this a whole bunch. Distract yourself until you can process it. And I did. I watched some stupid YouTube. Then I took a nap because I hadn't slept well the night before. And within a few hours, like, it wasn't an issue in it. Like, I was still sad, but there wasn't just, like, grief welling up in me.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't even something I had to go back later and, like, deal with or whatever. No, it's like, once I can relax a little bit and life is still happening and, you know.
Yep, yep.
And go from there.
Yeah.
I used to be, this was the antithesis of how I thought you handled things. You handle all things by facing them head on, dealing with them, talking about them, blah, blah, blah. Sometimes that just keeps you in that place longer for no good reason.
Well, I do think that even for people who like to approach it the way you're just saying, you talk about it or whatever, it's not always the appropriate time, you know.
Also true.
Sometimes it's like, okay, I do want to talk about this. I do want to deal with this. But right now is not the right time to do that. And I think people who know that and who take that break or whatever, oftentimes will come back later, like you've discovered, and, oh, well, I don't really need to talk about it now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was just talking with somebody about this the other day. The never go to bed angry.
Yeah, that's a very old
and piece shitty. Of it is a shitty piece of like. I used to like we all bought into it. I thought it was a thing, and then I realized it wasn't a thing, and then I realized it was the opposite of a thing. Like, if I mean, I'm not gonna say like anytime you're fighting, it's time to go to sleep, but if it's bedtime and you're fighting and you're angry, going to sleep is the best fucking thing you can do.
Well, I mean, it could be you're being tired is part of what's causing
it
the
almost
problem.
Always is at yeah, that point. Yeah. If it's like normally we would go to sleep, and staying up late to continue to deal with it is definitely not going to help.
Yeah.
And the number of times we have had fights and we sleep on it, and the next day it's like, you know, I'm not as mad. Or, you know, I thought about where you were coming from. Or like so many, sleeping on it can help a lot.
Yeah.
It's terrible advice.
Well, I think the reason that advice is given and is so popular is it's, I think the larger thing that it's trying to say is you might not deal with it later. Like, if you go to bed angry, you'll forget about it, but it'll still be there, and it'll just sit there and fester because you didn't deal with it. You went to bed instead.
I get it, and normalizing being angry and stuff, and I get that. But, I mean, that's another thing I've learned from marriage is, you know what? Sometimes just letting it go is the way to go.
Well,
because
yeah,
sometimes
that's
you have fights
true.
About dumb shit. And I'm the king of it. I mean, I've said before, in my dating days, I would be in a perfectly normal, okay relationship. I would get it in my head, sort of paranoid, like, that something was wrong, but I wouldn't know what it really was, but I would insist that we would talk about it, and I would badger my partner about that for so long that essentially I would create a problem that would then end the relationship. Mm. I did this multiple times.
Mm.
And I have had to learn from my wife and from my marriage in general. Sometimes the answer is no. I was mad. Like I was just. I was in a bad mood.
Yep.
Or we legitimately have different opinions about how to load the dishwasher.
And that's okay.
And we're just gonna have to go through life with
that.
Yeah.
All
that's, right. That's... We're just gonna have to come to terms. Nobody's winning. And in fact, if you are, that's probably way worse because that other person is going to be like,
right.
Like, sometimes you're just like, this is dumb. One of the largest fights Trish and I had recently was over light bulbs. And it was so dumb that we were leaving the house as we had it. And I just sort of stormed out to the car. And by the time I got to the car, I was laughing because it was so dumb. Because it wasn't even a personal opinion thing. It was about, give me the old light bulb. And all, like, we both thought we had extra information that the other one didn't about, like, where light bulbs were and stuff. But neither of us was saying that information. We're just like, give it to me, I'll handle it. She's like, no, give it to me. And I was like, I have information you don't. She's like, no, I have, fuck you, give me the light bulb. Like, and by the time I got to the car, and then she comes out afterwards, and I'm like, that was the dumbest. She's like, right? And we still bring it up now. We're like, yeah, we're going to fight about light bulbs. But then other fights, we got into a fight recently that got really bad. And it was a series of misunderstandings on both sides. But mostly somebody was just in an emotional place such that that was the thing that sort of snapped them.
Yeah, that happens sometimes.
And it got ugly and there were a lot of tears and stuff. And then eventually it was just us hugging. And there was like nothing. Like, we cleared up our misunderstandings.
Sure.
But there was nothing else. I was like, no, I was just really emotional then. And it burst forth. And I'm sorry that you had to witness that. But I mean, and it wasn't anything where anybody was yelling at anybody
or anything like that.
It was perfectly fine. But, and there's nothing to be dealt with. And in fact, the experience was the cathartic, and now they felt better. And
this makes me think of an article I read recently. The thesis was that, and I don't generally agree with this thesis. I think it's sort of looking at this problem the wrong way. but it was saying that as religion has receded in our culture's toolbox, if you will, for things to blame for things, we're left really to blame ourselves or each other. And so we do that more than we used to. And this was speaking specifically in if a bad thing happens to a child.
Yeah.
Right. You know, people wouldn't sit there and say the parents weren't vigilant enough because a kid, you know, rode his bike to school and wrecked it or something and got terribly hurt or died. Oh, you shouldn't let your kid do that. Or you should have, you know, someone's going to be blamed, usually the parent or someone who manufactured the bike. When there was a time when people were more religious where they would go, well, these things just happen. It's God's
God
ways.
Has a plan.
Yeah, God's ways are mysterious. Yeah. I think sometimes in relationships, people forget that some things just happen.
Yes.
they're not caused by anything. It's not that your partner or you.
That some things are unique to the experience.
Yeah, yeah,
this
right,
is
right.
In the same way that there isn't a diet plan that's going to work for everybody. That if you just follow this plan, you will lose weight. If you just follow this plan, you will get muscles. If you just there is no such thing. Everybody's, well, the intersectionality is crazy, but just the genetics alone for an individual are so different that there's not a single rule for that. There's also not a single rule for the best way for you to learn things. In the same way, there's not a single rule for the best way for you to make a marriage work with your particular partner.
Or parent.
Or parent.
Or a lot
or
of
Or child.
Things.
Or just friends.
Yeah, right.
Or podcast partner. Whatever. There's not...
one way.
There can be guidelines and perspectives that can be helpful to think about and consider, but there aren't hard and fast rules. There aren't universal rules to anything.
Well, why do you think people think there are? Because, like, this article was insinuating that people want the certainty and the assurance of a deity. And so when they don't have the deity, they replace it with the certainty and assurance of all these rules that are universal rules.
I think, and I hate this because this is the one time where I go into vaguely evolutionary psych, which is a horrible field of pseudoscience.
As we both agree.
This idea of... and I forget what the term is, and I need to remember it because it's great, but human tendency to look for patterns.
Right, right.
It's that kind of thing. It's a survival instinct that if we understand how things work and the rules, then we will be successful.
Right. And safe.
And that's
whatever.
The thing. Yeah, you want to know how... you want to know how to succeed, and so you need to know the rules for it.
Yeah.
Whereas the real answer is, you know, be observant, be open, pay attention.
Sure, but
and then you'll get there.
But none of that leads to a person concluding that the rules are universal. In fact, quite the opposite. If your experience, I mean, your experience tells you and my experience tells me that the rules are fairly situational and circumstantial. The conclusion that the rules that I experience in my life or the rules that I've seen in my parents or whatever are universal, that there's a logical step there that's not necessary.
No. That's there. Because it's so much easier. Because people want to be told the answers. They don't want to be told, you know what? You'll just have to figure it out yourself.
But
that sounds horrible.
What makes people like that? I mean, I don't know if people are
because
like that.
Because people fear getting it wrong.
Do you think...
so if some sort of authority figure...
do you think all...
can tell me...
people do?
The right answer.
Or just some cultures. I mean, our culture puts a certain premium on getting it right. So I understand people in our culture are afraid of getting it wrong. But are all cultures like that? Or are some cultures like, hey, it's okay to get it wrong? And it's like in
the I think
the culture?
It's issues of scale.
Okay.
Because keep in mind, a lot of these traits are survivability traits. There are issues about your health. There are issues about a successful relationship that will cause procreation, potentially. Things like this. There are issues about how to function in a society.
Right, but having strict and unadaptive rules for living is not a survival benefit. You know, if you live in a culture or in a tribe and they insist that rules are a certain way, that tribe is not going to last very long, maybe a couple generations. The whole point to human beings being adaptive is so that we don't really have the kind of instincts that other animals have, and the fact that that's true allows us to have a survival quotient that's, you know, better than just about anything else. If we replace our liberation from instinct with strict rules that we will never change no matter what happens in our environment, we're just replacing those instincts. And then when our culture no longer fits that biological niche, we will die along with all the other forms that rely on that niche.
Yep.
So it can't be true that in human history, the rule is that we have strict, unchanging rules. I mean, the tribes that survived would surely be able to relatively easily change the rules that they might have been living under for many years so that they could keep living when the circumstances change. So our culture, it does have very strict rules, and I think people are in our culture are afraid to fail. But I don't think that's, I would argue that's not a human nature thing. That's a
our culture's socially constructed, but at this point, I think it's pretty much globally socially constructed.
You think so? You think you're not going to be able to find a culture that is
okay
with failure?
Well, I'll put it this way. I don't think you're going to find a lot of cultures that thrive on change.
Thrive on change.
Because that's what we're talking about. People don't like to change. People don't like the idea that the way you've been doing it, the way you're used to, maybe the way you like, doesn't work anymore.
Well, you're talking about a specific kind of change, of course. I mean, people love change. They like to get married when they're not married. They like to have kids when they didn't have kids. So you mean something very specific when you're saying people don't like change.
Well, I don't mean something universal, I guess, but I don't know that's that specific. People don't like to change the way they have chosen to live their life. To quote the...
In broad strokes.
I don't like to quote him anymore, but he's accurate on some things. Louis C.K., people really hate doing their second favorite thing. They really want shit the way they want it. And not even something that's slightly less than the way they want it. And so, no, it's a matter of what you want. So if there's something in your life that you want change, if you're like, I'm single, I want to be married.
Yeah, right.
That's the thing. But if you're like, this is how I'm living my life. What? This is a terrible way of living my life? Fuck you. This is how I do it.
Yeah.
If this is what I'm used to, this is what I think has worked for me, and then you tomorrow say, and here's the thing. Sometimes it's because they're ignorant of what they've been doing. I didn't realize there were all these extra consequences. But sometimes it's the world of today is not the world of then, and it just doesn't work that way anymore. And that's a hard one to accept also.
But doesn't that just mean people don't like to feel like change is being forced upon them? I mean,
essentially.
I mean, I would say that is probably universal. I don't think anybody likes the change that comes to be someone else comes to them and says, well, we're going to do things my way now. And it's like, I want to do things my way. I mean, I do think people sort of universally do not like coercion or a feeling like they're being coerced.
Yeah.
Even if the person, quote unquote, that's coercing them is a personified force of nature or a deity. You know, if they
or
don't like feeling like they're being forced to do something.
The social structure they're around changing
right.
Without them.
Yeah.
And it's economies of scale again.
Yeah.
Because you get people who say you can't do that because this happens or this doesn't happen. And they say no, it doesn't. I go outside in my neighborhood every day, and that doesn't happen. And we're like, yeah, it doesn't happen in your neighborhood. So it doesn't happen. No, it just doesn't happen in your neighborhood. But it happens, so you need to stop it. This is a tricky thing.
It is a tricky thing.
And introspection is exhausting, and we're way over time.
Oh, sorry.
Hey, at the end here, it appears to have cured my cough, so...
All right.
Next week's going to be evil. Get ready for that, people. Mm. But in the meantime, please, please, please write in themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com and give us other stuff to talk about. Because, I mean, it's really the best thing you can do for humanity at this point.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.